We've been through the last couple of months working our way slowly through a list from not the earliest Buddhist tradition, but at the very beginnings of the Mahayana tradition called the Parami. And the word means perfection. So it's a list of qualities, basically, that are called the perfections of the heart. Qualities that, as practitioners, we are urged to cultivate. And in some ways, they're obvious. You know, one of them is loving kindness. One of them is patience or forbearance. We talked about a few weeks ago. Effort, wisdom, generosity, etc. And then we had 3 weeks ago today, and the whole thing got a little shaky. And then I was away for a week. So coming back into the series, just like jumping back into like, oh, where are we in the series? Ah, truth is actually the perfection that would be in the sequence that I speak about tonight. The Pali word is satya, the Sanskrit is satya. And in a certain way, the talk is always about truth, at least to the best of my ability. So in a certain way, it's easy, right, to bring any topic in. It's been an intense few weeks. We talked last week very much about grieving and how to be with in a practice way what's happening now in our country, in our world. So the perfection of truth has a few layers, of course, and they always do. I mean, on the simplest layer, it overlaps with the fourth of the precepts that we just chanted, the precept of wise speech, where the basic guideline of wise speech is not to lie, right? Is to speak the truth. And then it gets more complicated from there, right? The guidelines of wise speech start with speak the truth, but then they say, you should not only speak the truth, but you should speak things that are helpful. So in this era of, you know, at least in my little bubble, a lot of people saying a lot of things that are true, they're not all helpful. One thinks of, you know, various Facebook posts and things that might be true. There's actually a whole discourse going on right now in the world of social media around actually things that pretend to be true but aren't, that may have had very real consequences, right? The whole fake news conversation right now. So speaking truth and saying what's helpful. Helpful, of course, is an interesting requirement because it asks you to know what's helpful, which is itself a practice, right? And in a sort of fractal-like way, every piece of practice kind of opens downward, in a sense, to deeper practices, right? It's like, oh, I want to say what's true, but then I have to know what's true. I want to say what's helpful, but then I have to know what's helpful. And in a way, all the practices open into wisdom, to being wisdom practices, discernment practices, right? Well, what's actually helpful? It's like, well, what's helpful is what leads to less suffering. Well, how do I know what's going to lead to less suffering? It's like, well, that takes experience and guidance and lineage, probably, and ancestors and teaching and all sorts of things. In addition to speech being true and helpful, it's then urged that it be kind. And boy, is there a lot of unkind speech happening right now from all sides. And, very interestingly, there's an argument out there, certainly in some parts of the left, that some kinds of unkind speech might actually be helpful in this moment because they meet or counteract other kinds of unkind speech that folks who aren't trying to be kind are doing. So then one might say, and this argument is out there, certain kinds of unkind speech are actually more helpful in a certain moment than kind speech. And that is an example, and there's lots of them in difficult times. Unfortunately, I think we'll probably talk about a lot of these over the next years. That might be an example of a place where a kind of conventional ethic, or even a radical political ethic, that might well be true, by the way, right? It might actually be the case that certain kinds of what we would call harsh speech turn out to be useful in times like this. I might not even argue with that. And at the same time, there's a perspective, from the perspective of a body of teachings, and in this case, a body of teachings called the Dharma, coming from the Theravada Buddhist lineage. This is primarily a Southeast Asian Buddhist lineage. The teaching still holds that kind speech is preferable. And so then we get to say, oh, right, do I commit to kindness in my speech as part of my inner practice? Like, I'm working toward clarity, and that's a good practice to do? Or do I hinge toward, like, my social or radical practice where a certain kind of harshness might be called for? And that's a challenging practitioner question, right? And we find this in many ways in so many of the ethical questions around practice, right? Do I go full nonviolence, or do I bring in, you know, smashing the state? Just as an example, right? Which is not usually nonviolent. Don't know, right? Do I go nonviolence? And what does that mean for self-protection, which we know is so important? So, and as a philosopher, I'm actually really, I'm happy about this, because I'm nervous about teachings that are easy, because they never seem to be true. Ultimately, right? Life, as far as I can tell, maybe the next 46 years gets easier, but the first ones suggest that complexity is the rule, right? That things are not actually kind of a simple thing that can be responded to with a simple response, and that is enough. So, wise speech. Under the perfection of truthfulness, speech is suggested that we practice towards speech that is true, kind, helpful. And then the fourth guideline is timely. Timely. Something can be true, kind, and helpful, but it's not the right moment to say it. And that's a beautiful, I think, sensitive piece. I think the folks who compiled these lists, they got something in that one. They're like, oh yeah, that's true. And they're partly thinking about, you know, like the cycles of monastic life. There's a beautiful text where it's called the Bahia Discourse. There's a wanderer, an ascetic, a practitioner named Bahia. He's not studying under the Buddha. He's an independent practitioner. He was called Bahia of the bark cloth, meaning he wore a very rough, probably uncomfortable on purpose outfit. And he was living in a cave by the ocean, practicing, trying to get liberated. And at one point he asks kind of a question sort of to the air, basically. He says, as you might think to yourself at some point in your practice, he thinks, is my practice getting me to liberation? Is this correct practice? Am I doing it right? And a spirit shows up, a deva, a angel-type spirit shows up. And the commentary says the spirit is actually Bahia's cousin who had died and comes to him as a spirit being and says, oh, actually, Bahia, no, your practice is not leading to liberation. You're practicing in the wrong way. And It's great when the spirits show up and they tell you this, right? They're like, no, you're not doing it right. You have to watch out because you might get that message a lot. It's not always the spirits talking. It might just be you, at which point. The general teaching is to ignore that voice. But Bahia knows that we could psychologize it and say he asks very sincerely of himself. He assesses his practice and he gets an intuitive hit that is correct, that he's not actually practicing in the right way. And he says, oh my gosh, well, what should I do? And the spirit says, well, there's this guy, the Buddha, he lives in this place. The text says, Bahia left without even cleaning up, basically. He just like dashed out of the cave he was living in. And in mythological time, it says he covered the entire distance between places that are a couple hundred miles apart in earth miles in a day. So he runs, is what it really... he's driven by the desire to practice in a way that would lead to liberation. And he gets to the grove where the Buddha is living. It's early morning, like dawn. And they say, oh, the Buddha's not here. He's out on alms round, right? He's gathering his food for the day. And they say, but, you know, don't worry, he'll be back in an hour. And Bahia is like, there's no time to waste, right? Like, I got the hit, I gotta go. He runs into town, he finds the Buddha walking quietly with his alms bowl, prostrates himself in the dust and says, blessed one, teach me the path to liberation. And the Buddha, who in the texts always knows everybody's name before they say it, I don't know how that works. I forget people's names after they've said them, but... the Buddha says, now is not the time, Bahia. We are on alms round. Bahia says, I can't wait. Like, teach me the teachings of liberation. And the Buddha says, Bahia, now is not the time. Right? It's not timely. And Bahia says a third time, which is always a thing with the Buddha. You ask three times, something happens. He asks a third time, and this time, and he's good. He actually gets the Buddha with his own teaching. He says, but blessed one, the future is uncertain, which the Buddha teaches all the time, right? He says, if the future is uncertain, one does not know what will happen between now and after lunch. Teach me now. And the Buddha says, okay, Bahia, practice in this way. And he gives him a short, beautiful teaching that goes like this. In the seeing is just seeing. In the hearing is just hearing. In the sensing with the body is just sensing. Practicing in this way, you will be neither here nor there nor in between. Just that is the end of suffering. So he gives him two verses of suffering, right? So the first three lines are basically a mindfulness practice. In the seeing is just the seeing. When you see something, don't add a conceptual overlay. Don't make a story about it. There's just what is seen. In the hearing, it's just what is heard. In the sensing, it's just the sensing, right? It's not my body with my arthritic thumb and my suffering because I'm not as young as I used to be. That's all overlay. There's just a sensation. That's it. And the sensing is just the sensing. And then he gives a kind of wisdom teaching. Knowing this, you will be neither here nor there nor in between. Right? The one who practices and sees in this way can't be tied down, can't be fixed to any place, because all the fixing is story. The thing that says, you know, I'm Sean, I'm 46, I'm a new dad, I live in Oakland, I'm grumpy about politics. All of those are stories that somehow pin down an identity. If I don't do that, and nobody does that, like if I don't do that, right, then what is there? Right? Right now I see light, I see people, I see colors, mostly warm, ambery tones. If I don't make any stories about that, if I don't even use those words for it, there's not much to do from that point. And I can't even say, I'm here doing this, because already, right, I'm gone in a certain way. I am gone in a certain way, that the self empties out. He gives him a very deep teaching in about 20 seconds. You'll be neither here nor there nor in between. Just this is the end of suffering. Right? Oh, suffering comes not because of what I'm seeing, but because of the story I wrap around what I'm seeing. It's a good thing that the Buddha broke his own timeliness rule, because the story says that Bahia bowed to the Buddha and reflecting on these teachings was instantly liberated. Like, he got it. His practice had actually been strong, he just hadn't had the right teaching. He got it instantly. And this is good, because on the way back to the grove, he was killed by a rampaging cow. Aww. I know. Whenever we do this story, people are always like, why? That's terrible. He was such a nice guy. He really wanted, you know. And but there you go. That's the story. He was right. You never know what will happen between now and the end of lunch. He had a quality that I'll talk about sometime. It's a beautiful quality called samvega, urgency for practice. Like, there's no time to waste. The Buddha went back to the grove, and the monks said, oh, this guy Bahia, he was looking for you. The Buddha said, yeah, he found me. And they were like, we heard he died. And whenever anybody dies, they ask the Buddha where he goes, because it's important to them to know. And the Buddha said, he actually was fully liberated before he died, so he's done. He became one of the arhants, the perfected ones. So that was just a digression, but I love that story. And it contains a really good teaching. Timeliness. So the four guidelines for wise speech are truthfulness, kindness, helpfulness, and timeliness. So that's one level of truth. Truthfulness as a perfection. But all of them, like I said, they open, I think of it as downward, or they deepen, they have roots that go further down into the wisdom teachings. And this is where we get to, in a sense, touch the intensity of the time that we're living in a little bit more. At the heart of the teachings that the Buddha left behind is this urging toward what we could call discrimination or discernment. I don't like discrimination because it means the wrong thing nowadays. Discernment. And discernment is a way of saying my senses and my faculties, my perception is awake and bright, and I'm able to see clearly. The word vipassana that is now used for a style of meditation practice, it means to see clearly. It means clear seeing, and so that's this wise perception in a way. And what discernment asks of us, what the wisdom practices ask of us, is to, as deeply as we can, strip away the aspects of a given thing that cause suffering and are not intrinsic to the thing. In other words, we are to separate out. It's a discernment is a bit of a separating out process, right? On the wisdom level, this is a deconstructive process. We analyze things and we say, I'm a little heartbroken. That's a feeling. It's a painful feeling. Okay, well, what's there in that feeling? Well, my body feels kind of heavy. It feels like there's a rock in my belly. Okay, what else is there? Well, there's fear of the future. Okay, there's fear of the future. What's that fear? How come fear? What's up with fear? It's like, oh, the fear is intertwined with a story. And the story is that our government has gone from bad to worse, and that a lot of people I love are now more afraid for their lives and well-being than they were before. And I'm not particularly targeted as much as some. And so I'm afraid, in a certain way, primarily for some people that I love. And then, as an extension, for a lot of people that I know are quite afraid right now. So we can take this apart. Discernment says, take apart the experience of this moment and see what's actually happening. What I'm going to get is essentially a layer of thoughts, so a bunch of stories that are playing out, you know, layers of feeling, some of which are pleasant, like the feeling of loving my friends, and some of which are unpleasant, like fearing for their safety. And then layers of things like worldview and ideology, you know. Like, I have the view that tolerance is better, right? And I happen to think that view is correct. But the view itself and the idea that it's correct are also both just layers in what's happening now. And it's important to recognize them as layers or as phenomena or as things I can be aware of, rather than absolute truth. Part of what this practice does, and I think part of what can be so helpful for us right now, is that it knocks all of our cherished truths off the pedestal. Right? Everything you believe in is simply a thing that you believe in. And you learned it from somewhere. And, you know, you're all good folks. You're right, probably, mostly. That's what I think, anyway. But that doesn't matter, actually, right? Because the question of whether the belief is right or not, and all that means is, to me, is, you know, more helpful rather than less helpful, leads to less suffering rather than more suffering. It turns out that rightness isn't what it's about, as far as liberation goes. For liberation, what you want to do is say, oh, what's happening here is stories and feelings and worldview, core ideology, physical sensations. And we can expand from that and to say, like, oh, and relationships. Like, there's direct human relationships happening, which are constructed out of all that other stuff. And as we do this, what we're doing is we're peeling away layers of what seems like truth into more and more a sense of, in a way, like, how complex the truth is really what I'll say. It's not that anything's actually untrue. Some Buddhist systems would appear at different times to say, oh, anything that can be deconstructed is therefore an illusion, right? I could say, oh, there's not really a clock, there's just a bunch of plastic and metal and electricity and creativity and ideas and, you know, oppressive, you know, labor in a factory somewhere and the history of colonialism and, you know, and the Gregorian calendar. And, like, there's a whole layer of ideas and material here, such that we would say, well, what is clock then? It's like, oh, it's just a composite idea. So some traditions would say that means that clock is an illusion. I don't do that. I adhere to a system that says, it's a clock. The clock is real. All that other stuff is also real. Real just doesn't mean permanent, right? It's a clock for a while. And, you know, if I took it home and my baby did what he did with it, which is to go like this, you know, pretty soon it's not a clock, right? It's a baby toy, and then it's in the dustpan, and then it's landfill, you know? We've been calling him Mr. Destructo lately. Some of you have met him. He's a good chap. He's discovering his strength. So truth can be thought of as a practice instruction to dig into our experience of the world, which means relationships with people and stuff, basically, in ourselves, ideas and cultures and history. And it's almost like let go of obsessing about being right and become obsessed by almost like this will be a very tantric way to say it, like like delighting in the fullness of things. You know, it would be a way of saying, oh, it's so complicated, right? And because it's complicated, you start to see patterns in things, right? My relatives in Kentucky, my in-laws in Kentucky, who are full on for Trump, you start to see, like, oh, they're people. They're good people. They're good Christians. Their economy's been destroyed. Why was the economy destroyed? Well, because tobacco was destroyed as a crop. You know, well, why? Well, partly because we decided that smoking wasn't so good for you, and partly because we ended slavery, and partly because of other things that are, I would say, good. But then we demolished the tobacco economy. So then the only thing that's left in their little Kentucky town is OxyContin and meth cooking and really an unhealthy social fabric. And I start to feel like the heart of understanding is just to know more history. And if you know any history of a place and people, how could you hate someone? Right? Because you see more and more of the web of what's in there. I think that orienting toward truth means, in a certain way, not judging anybody for anything. Because the thing you're judging them for is the product of complex conditions that you could see if you simply look. This begs the question whether there's an ultimate truth at the bottom of anything, and I'll leave that one open since it's a 3,000-year-old unanswerable question. But if you want to go there, let me know. I'll tell you about, you know, absolute ideas about absolute truth. But that's a good start for now. Truth as a speech practice and truth as a wisdom practice of discernment and deconstruction with an ethical vow at its basis. So let's take just a moment to kind of let it rest. Listen a little bit, and the hearing is just the hearing. Right on. So thanks for listening warmly, kindly. We take the last chunk of our time together just for open discussion, hear from some other voices, questions about practice, reflections on this topic, or anything that's up for you right now. Yes, Stephanie.
Can you give an example of some harmful speech that might be useful and what you're thinking of when you say that?
Sure.
Not necessarily the kindest.
Unkind. I don't want speech to be harmful.
Right, yeah,
I don't want to
yeah.
cause harm. But
it's supposed to be helpful.
Right.
It's supposed to be helpful. And, unkind in a certain way, might be, as simple as saying, holy shit, the president-elect seems like a kind of like insane narcissist, but he's also just a jerk, and it's just not, it wouldn't be kind to say so. It might be true, I don't know, but and it might even be helpful to the extent that it allows, say, grieving liberals to feel like they've been heard and they have a place for their grief. Maybe there's a place for that, And maybe there's not. Our current discourse has gotten really harsh. you know, certainly there's a place, I would say, for a certain kind of fierceness, you know. You get, you know, you're getting a certain kind of attention from a person who feels unsafe, and it's appropriate to say, you know, back off, MF, you know. Right? So there's a kind of unkindness in self-protective speech, for instance, which I think is a better example than just insulting Mr. Trump. But I can imagine situations where both of them would be in a certain way, in a sort of psychodynamic way, helpful, at least for a moment.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then what I want as a practitioner actually is to clarify my intentions and actions so that that is less and less my habit.
Yeah.
You know, that's not my kind of activism. It is other folks'
right.
style. But it's not mine.
Yeah. To me, even calling out something like narcissism can be done in a kind way. Because actually, I think narcissism is actually a mental health issue. Like, it's a very, like, kind of a problem, you know?
For sure.
Yeah.
For sure.
And so that, I mean, and not to say that, like, we just say, oh, poor narcissist, like, and just kind of leave it alone at that. But, like, definitely, like, having some empathy for the narcissist aspects of him, but at the same time, like you said, meeting that with a fierceness, like, I feel like the two can be combined in a way that's not just like, oh, what a narcissistic jerk, you know?
You know, it's actually fine that he's a jerk. It would just be better for him not to be in power.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, exactly.
But again, you know, we're in agreement, really. You know, we're very nice hippies, and it's very difficult even to come up with a useful, unkind thing to say. I have some friends who would have 1,000 examples quickly for this, right? Because in a certain way, there's they're around. They're around. Yeah. You can find them on my Facebook feed, commenting snarkily to things. Other thoughts? Yeah.
I have a relevant question.
Please.
About truth and actually emotions. It's about kind of political situation.
Yeah.
So I decided not to talk to my family.
Mm-hmm.
Helpful,
timely. Yeah.
It's like, because my speech would be kindly unkind to them. Like I kind of overreacted a few days ago and I just couldn't control myself. So I told them, I'm not even speaking to you right now. And my sister, who's still in Russia, in her family there are going to be some serious health issues.
Mm.
So now I'm like, I'm thinking, would it be selfish not to talk to her, but you know, I kind of need to express some sympathy and support, but at the same time, I'm really angry at her, and I don't know how to express my sympathy and still deal with my anger emotions and kind of do it civilized.
Mm-hmm.
I'm still not at the place where I can, as you say, like, see the truth from their eyes and from my eyes and kind of react to that in a civil way. I'm like, I'm very, very uncivilized right now, like, in my thoughts and emotions, so.
You're not alone in that one.
Yeah, but I also, like, I don't want to act selfish because, you know, as you mentioned, like, things are changing, like, in a few years, things might be different, but family is still family.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the things that are happening there is just kind of becoming very serious. And, you know, if I'm not going to act on it now, it would be too late later. And that moment will be lost. And they will not forgive me for that.
Mm. Yeah.
So I'm kind of battling.
Yeah. It's a real practitioner question, you know, that there's, the relationship is complex, and you have many layers of feelings, right? You're partly angry and partly loving, and they can exist at the same time. Of course, we're angry at people we love, you know, all the time. Part of what your practice can be is, you know, how can I be authentic with them? How can I be real with these people in a time that seems to be calling for that, right? When there's illness, when there's serious life change happening, you want to show up and you want to be kind and express sympathy and support them. And maybe it's a time to figure out how to separate the angry part from the sympathy part, you know, to not need to have them both present with you as you're engaging with them. Almost like you say, I'm angry with them for these reasons. I'm just going to put that in, you know, I'm put that over here for now and express my sympathy. And of course, in a very practical way, don't talk about politics, right? Say, how are you feeling? I hope you're feeling better. How's your comfort? Are you getting the right kind of care? You know. And it's delicate. It's delicate. You know. Part of our strength that we build as practitioners is to be able to sit with and hold our own feelings. And so your part of your practice can be to hold your feelings as true, even your anger at the situation, but still show up for your family in a way that your heart wants to, you know. And then maybe you come back and you come to a friend and you're like, that was so hard, you know. exactly. And there's a good place for that, you know.
So, I feel as though there's an impasse here, and maybe you can help me out of this impasse. So, earlier in the talk, you referred to the suspension of judgment,
yeah,
if I can call it that, for these purposes. And then we find ourselves in a situation in which, and I'm trying to paraphrase Baldwin, I may get it slightly wrong, you have a world in which certain people are expressing their freedoms in such a way that curtail the freedom and security of others.
Yeah.
This strikes me as not a moment of the suspension of judgment.
Mm-hmm. Totally. This is a moment for the suspension of judgment of the people as intrinsically bad people. Right. But yeah, the word judgment is overbroad. It's too broad in this case. It's a moment for discernment, and clear and discernment of, and we would call this judging in a way, the results of actions. Mm. Like, these actions are leading to this result. And the judgment that's always present in Buddhist practice anyway is, does this lead to more suffering or less? Mm. Right? But yeah, I mean, in a certain way, you know, the Christians actually say this very well. I don't like how they put this saying into action, when they say, you know, love the sinner, hate the sin. There's a, and it really, I wish there was more loving of sinners going on right now, can I just say? Mm-hmm. I don't see as much of it as I would like in an active way. But there you go. And I wouldn't use the word hate either. But given that, there is the sense in it that, you know, no human being is intrinsically flawed. In the Christian system, that's because human beings are created by God, they're basically good. Fallen, but good. In the Buddhist system, it's because there's no one there anyway. There is no intrinsic self to be intrinsically flawed. If you look with discernment, what you find is an ever-changing web of conditioned phenomena, which are the results of previous situations. So, like, I'm basically a good guy, but one of my great flaws in, you know, postmodern relationship is that I have a very dull relationship with my emotions. I don't have much access to them. I'm more or less happy as long as nothing goes wrong. And when things go wrong, all I do is I get a little glum. And this doesn't do so well sometimes in intimate relationship. But I know exactly where it came from, right? It's like, oh, well, my dad does it exactly that way. And I was adopted in a certain way. I've always been distant from relationship. That's what I blame it on anyway. And having some sense of that, I, in a certain way, don't take it personally, which is also one of the strengths of having that particular quality around emotions, is that I don't take it personally. From a Buddhist sense, it's wise. But what it means, and I've been wanting to talk about this more. We'll get to it another week soon. There's this beautiful thing, and it relates to judgment, in this system around karma and conditionality. Bless you, bless you, bless you. And it says essentially this. Nobody is guilty because of harmful action, but everyone is responsible for their actions. Right? So my actions right now of being a certain kind of guy are conditioned by the past. In other words, they're not my fault. But that still means I'm responsible for what I do in relation to them. So like, I can't use the excuse that karmically they're not my fault. In an intimate moment with my friends or partner where they're like, I wish you would, you know, show up more emotionally. And I can't say, it's just my nature, right? Well, I could. It doesn't work very well. It doesn't go anywhere. The right answer in a certain way is I'm so sorry, it's my nature. And here's what I want to do about that. Like, here's what we can do about that. I'm responsible for my actions, even though I recognize what the conditions are, right? When someone walks down the street who's substantially different looking than me and I have a flash of fear and some part of me goes, oh, look, systemic racism. My practice must be, in a certain way, to not take that personally, right? The way that some of the practice right now around overcoming racism is for people to announce loudly, hey, I'm a racist, right? What they're really saying is, I notice that systemic racism and bias is in me. The way it's the water we swim in. It can't not be. I don't do that style. Being a Buddhist, I don't do so much of the I am announcement thing. I would more say, oh, look, systemic racism is here. It is present in my experience. It would be impossible for it not to be, given who I am and where I live and the history here. And this offers a beautiful thing, which is freedom from judgment. I'm not a bad person because of it. But it offers actually a beautiful space for responding and acting in a kind and wholesome way. Partly because it gives me a little bit of space from feeling blamed or guilty, right? I get to escape from a layer of guilt and then actually just act more wisely in relationship to it. Part of how I think about this is that these things that are poisons, greed, hatred, delusion, are the three classic poisons. But we could add our modern poisons, the manifestations of greed, hatred, and delusion, of like racism, sexism, misogyny, ableism, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, homophobia, transphobia, yada, yada. Xenophobia, white supremacy, etc. All of these things we can think of as almost like airborne diseases or culture-borne diseases. Nobody is guilty for having gotten the flu. You just got it. And we happen to live in a culture where there's an epidemic of certain diseases, and everybody's got them. So, you know, and some people have got them really bad, and some people have a more mild case, and you're lucky if you got a mild case. But nobody owns them. right? And all you have to do is try to get healthy. So the possibility of being freedom from judgment by seeing clearly and disidentifying with things. What do you think?
Thank you. It's a helpful point of differentiation. And from the standpoint of personal spiritual practice, it makes all the sense in the world to me.
Yeah.
I'm a historian. Mm-hmm. The shift in language from a set of metaphors that involve causation.
Yes.
And guilt to one that is almost microbial, right? This microbial world in which there are these sort of cultures of, say, xenophobia or racism that certain people have a degree of inoculation against and other people don't, right? This shift in metaphorical framing for me is difficult.
Yeah, for sure.
But from the standpoint of spiritual practice, it makes all the sense in the world.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Buddhist practice performs this very difficult metaphorical shift in many ways because the core metaphor of the self is missing. Right? So many of our common ideologies hinge on the assumption of a separate individual self. And when that itself is questioned, the other layers shake, right. So a whole conversation that we're having right now around personal responsibility, neoliberalism, etc. That's fine. We can say, like capitalist entrepreneurs, socialist, communitarian ideas. That level is one level, but they both depend on the idea of the individual, as being a thing, and so. From a Buddhist perspective, if you undermine that, the whole conversation changes. And that's where I like the microbial kind of metaphor. I like that word for it. Mm-hmm. Anything else before we close for the night? Good. Mm-hmm. Right on. So it's a pleasure to be here, to open into investigation together, to sit together. Welcome to our new time on Tuesday nights. We're preceded by my longtime friend and one-time teacher, David Moreno's Vinyasa class. If you want to come and get your yoga on before this, make it a full evening. I recommend it. I'm not teaching much in the upcoming months, going on a short sabbatical, so I'll see you here or around. As always, and continuing, this group is offered fully on donation. That means that we push against the capitalist model, not by offering it for, quote, free, which is still within the capitalist model. It means something in that model. But actually by saying that our resources mean more and go further when they are freely gifted. And because it's Giving Tuesday, you can give freely and generously, I was asked if I was okay if the studio's portion of the donations tonight is sent to Standing Rock, and I said that would be a great idea, and so I think we'll just send all of it to Standing Rock, because any little bit helps. Some folks who are really putting their lives on the line to try to defend a body of water from the state. So give generously. Normally the donations are split in half between the studio, myself, and tonight they'll all go to North Dakota. So thank you for your generosity. See you again soon. Mm-hmm.